From Public Radio International, I'm Christopher Lighton. This is The Whole Wide World. Testing the empire idea, the Uncle Sam solution to the troubles of the world, and counting on your calls in the next hour to open up the riddles of a globalizing planet. The SARS panic is a pretty good metaphor of the way things travel these days. Almost overnight, from village China to the quarantining of Toronto, not just mystery viruses, but money, mayhem, fear, fashion, music, movies, all have instant global reach, not to mention the instruments of war and terror. Are those global jet streams of power and culture pulling the world together faster than they're tearing us apart? Start with Iraq. Did American might make right and stability for the long run? Is Americanization the truer name for globalization? Will the Made in America label drive the world majority to distraction? The global emergency and the imperial moment are next on The Whole Wide World.
Thank you.
I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is The Whole Wide World, inviting your calls this hour on the ism of our time, globalism. Does the word ring differently with new facts and victorious American troops on the ground in Iraq? Through 7 hours of global radio, we've been taking notice of the planetary dimensions of so many things we hope for and worry about. Sum it up this hour. Is it good news or bad that the air and water of a warming planet, the tunes we hum, the websites we believe, the exotic flavors in our food, the pandemic viruses in our nightmares, the perks and the poverty that are allocated by a world trading system, all of these things flow far beyond any local or national lines in our minds or on the map. Here's the question. If the bad global trends don't kill us, will the good global trends make us stronger? The Whole Wide World phone is 800-886-9364. More particularly, how would you change our thinking and our institutions to make a global system work for the many, not just the few? The Scots historian Neil Ferguson, our guest from New York, says empire is the answer. He says, wake up, America, to your global role, spreading law, free trade, and modern life to a hungering world. Not so fast, says our guest in the studio, the Yale Law professor Amy Chua. Our American slogans of easy democracy and open markets, she says, are inflaming hatred and inequality worldwide. Call us up, listeners, at 800-886-9364, or go online and send your two bits to thewholewideworld.net. Neil Ferguson, welcome. The American empire is out of the closet, out of denial in Iraq. I'd love your opinion on whether we're looking at the future there, and does the future work?
Well, it remains to be seen whether it works. I hope it works, in the sense that I hope the United States has the attention span and the sense of commitment to see through what it has barely begun to do in Iraq. We call it nation building today. It's a euphemism in many ways, because what the United States is doing bears a close resemblance to what Britain did starting back in 1917 in Iraq. That's to say, trying to take this former Ottoman province and introduce it to the benefits of the free market, the rule of law, and ultimately representative institutions. But I fear that if the United States is true to form, and we only need to go back less than 10 years to Haiti for a very short-lived and unsuccessful intervention, that the military strikes won't be followed up by successful institution building. We are at a crossroads historically, and I think the United States needs to make a big decision about whether it's got the stamina for this kind of undertaking.
But that is the question. I keep wondering, reading your book, whether Americans, just emotionally, historically, in the sense of ourselves, are cut out for this role of overlordship in the world. We're different folks from you Brits.
Well, I think this is a very common line of argument, and Americans obviously have in their folk memory the sense that their nation was forged in reaction to British imperialism, that therefore they are somehow incapable of running an empire themselves. But I think there's a real element of denial about this. After all, the United States has been repeatedly intervening in the affairs of other countries since 1898, when the Philippines were annexed. And it really is time to stop pretending that we're back in the age of George Washington to the age of George Bush.
Let's go back to the age of George Washington. It fascinates me that the cover of your book in the American edition shows a picture of British warships burning Charlestown, that's Boston, in 1776 and winning the Battle of Bunker Hill that we were all raised on. We know who the bad guys were. It was the guys in the gunships. And you're saying now, get real, Americans, you are the gunships now, and take that heat. Do people turn around that way?
Well, I think it's perfectly possible that they can. Of course, my book makes it clear that the American War of Independence was really a British civil war fought within a wider English-speaking transatlantic empire, and that it was an avoidable civil war. It was really the result of egregious mistakes by policymakers in London. So I don't think your listeners should get the idea that I'm breaking a lance for King George III and Lord North. They screwed up in a fairly disastrous way. And I think from that point of view, the lessons to be learned aren't really from 18th century British imperialism. After all, the 18th century was still a time when the British did not believe in free trade and did seek essentially to exploit the countries that came under their control, particularly in Asia. For me, the really interesting lessons can be learnt from the way the British Empire functioned 100 years later. Go back to the later 19th century, a time when the British were entirely committed to free trade, when they had a much larger area of the world under their control, something like a quarter, and when they systematically exported not only capital, but also their institutions. And by those institutions, I mean the rule of law, particularly a particular kind of law, common law, and also an idea that administration should not be corrupt. Now, these are very important institutions in modern development economics. It's widely realized that one reason, sub-Saharan Africa, for example, but you could cite other cases, one reason why countries there are so poor is that they don't have an effective rule of law, and their administrations are tremendously corrupt. And I was speaking at the World Bank about this last week, and I made the case that if you read through a lot of what's written about development economics today, what you get is a checklist of the things that British imperial administrators were doing about 100 years ago.
But I've just got to challenge you on the rule of law and the lack of corruption. I mean, the American intervention in Iraq is going to be pilloried in a lot of places as an illegal war and an extension of crony capitalism. Halliburton, Bechtel, and the rest. I mean, let's try to see it sort of from several sides.
Well, I mean, there's no doubt that the intervention in Iraq did have a basis in international law. Nobody can claim that the UN resolution did not authorize the use of force. And I think in that sense, we've moved on from that debate, and it's hardly worth raking up those old embers.
What do you mean, the United Nations,
the other members of the Security Council, particularly France, sought to prevent any more explicit authorization for the action. But I don't think one can claim that Jacques Chirac was motivated by high considerations of international legality. He was motivated by national self-interest. And I think that motivation has led him into a rather considerable diplomatic embarrassment now. But the wider question you raise is a serious one. It's very important that when the United States sets about reconstructing Iraq, it is not seen to do it exclusively out of self-interest. And I think one can see fairly clearly that it's a real myth that big oil companies in this country stand to gain from what's being done in Iraq. This is really one of these favorite conspiracy theories of the left. And I always ask people who make this case if they've checked out the Halliburton share price lately, and they never have because they never look at these things. In fact, it's declined by 50% since George Bush came to power. And the war in Iraq has done nothing whatsoever to improve its performance. So if Halliburton is cynically exploiting the position of former executives in the White House and other parts of the U.S. administration, it's doing it remarkably unsuccessfully.
Stand by, Neil Ferguson. I want to remind listeners that the phone is 800-886-9364. This is the whole wide world, and we're talking about the future of globalization. Amy Chua's book is called World on Fire. It's all about the alienation, the anger, the inequality that seemed to come with the American idea of markets and democracy around the world. Amy Chua, imagine how this plays in Iraq from now on.
Well, I think this is a very precarious and dangerous moment. I think the current talk about trying to install free market democracy and even the rule of law in Iraq, almost like a light bulb, just installing it that way, is part of a much larger and very troubling global pattern. Since the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, the U.S. has been vigorously and naively promoting a kind of raw version of capitalism and democratization all over the non-Western world. And I think this worldwide spread of markets and democracy is in many ways what globalization's been all about. The problem is that when you try to foist free market democracy on countries with ethnic and religious and social structures totally different from the United States, whether you're talking about Indonesia or Zimbabwe or Iraq, the results have not been peace and prosperity, but typically instead violence and disaster. And in particular, one thing I think most Americans are not aware of is that markets and democracy are not always mutually reinforcing. And in particular, in many non-Western countries, markets and democracy actually tend to benefit different ethnic groups, creating an explosive situation. And I'll talk about Iraq in a second, but to illustrate with Indonesia very quickly, free market policies in the 1980s and 1990s led to a grotesque situation in which the country's tiny 3% Chinese minority controlled an astounding 70% of the private economy. Now, the introduction of democracy in 1998, which was hailed with euphoria in the United States, unfortunately produced a violent backlash against both markets and democracy. 5,000 shops and homes of ethnic Chinese were burned and looted. Over 2,000 people died. 150 Chinese women were gang raped. Politicians sought to get votes by calling for confiscation of Chinese assets. And the result was the wealthiest Chinese left the country, taking with them between $40 and $100 billion of their capital, plunging that country into an economic crisis from which it has still not recovered. And I think in Iraq, this is another very ethnically divided society. And, you know, people toss around analogies. I happen to think that the analogies of that post-Second World War Japan and Germany are terrible analogies for Iraq. For this simple reason, by 1945, Germany had exterminated most of its non-Aryan population. And like Japan, was extremely ethnically homogeneous. I think a better analogy for post-war Iraq is actually post-Tito Yugoslavia. Like the former Yugoslavia, Iraq's ethnic dynamics are really complicated, including cross-cutting conflicts across Kurds and Shiites and Christians and Sunnis, many horrendous massacres, and as a result, deep feelings of hatred and the need for revenge, and in particular, the Shiites. Oh, sorry.
You know too much about the many situations around the world, like the Chinese in Indonesia, where an ethnic minority has done boomingly, phenomenally well on the explosion of markets, and the great mass of poor majority has expanded. The warning, I think, for all of us is that the United States begins to look like the world ethnic minority that thrives on the explosion of these markets, while 5 of the 6 billion people are getting poorer all the time. The question is, how does this play out? Is this a viable future?
Well, I think that, I spent a lot of time in my book focusing on individual nations. But I do suggest by analogy that at the global level, yes, the United States has essentially become sort of the world's market dominant minority, viewed everywhere as wielding wildly disproportionate power relative to our size and numbers. And I think
Neil Ferguson, can that be made to work?
Well, it seems to me that although I'm inclined to agree with Amy about one crucial point, namely that excessively rapid democratization can backfire, not only in the way that she cites, but in other ways too. You don't actually need to have ethnically heterogeneous societies for democracy to backfire. It's perfectly possible, and it happened in Europe in between the wars, for democratization to backfire. Italy was almost completely homogeneous, but democratization backfired there because it was very easy to mobilize new voters, essentially to vote democracy out of existence. That's what Mussolini did. So I think we've got to recognize here that democratization isn't necessarily the first thing you do when you intervene and overthrow an authoritarian regime. And just one point that one ought to emphasize here, Amy's arguments shouldn't, I think, be taken to mean that democracy is somehow a bad thing. I hope that's not what she's driving at.
No, absolutely not. I
think the key thing is really all about timing here. And the same is true of the argument that I make. The British Empire wasn't supposed to be a permanent disenfranchisement of subject peoples. In fact, it was designed to gradually introduce representative government all over the area that British ruled, beginning in the places where it seemed the situation was most suitable. So I think the key point here is to emphasize that if you're introducing free markets, the key thing to introduce with them is A, the rule of law, and B, a fairly non-corrupt system of administration. And it's only really when economic development is quite well established and you've got the rule of law firmly secured that one can actually make a stable transition to democracy. And I think that's something that American policymakers have tended to get wrong in the past. The belief tends to be, and it was very clear, of course, in the wake of the collapse of communism, shock therapy in the markets and then hold free elections and the rest will take care of itself. But it's not like that. If you introduce democracy in countries that are relatively economically backward, if you introduce democracy in countries where the rule of law isn't established, all that tends to happen is that minorities are oppressed and very quickly democracy itself is wound up.
Neil Ferguson, I want to come back to the empire pitch. It seems to me that the sort of neo-imperial energy in the Bush administration, sort of the Rumsfeld impulse, Cheney too perhaps, has been pretty clear since 9/11, surely, maybe from the beginning. But why would the rest of the world, which has learned to speak in its own voice in the 40, 50 years since the colonial empires fell apart, why would the rest of the world want to be put back in that position?
Well, I don't think anybody is seriously talking about proclaiming the American empire from the rooftops. Of course, the phrase has been much more in discussion since 9/11 than it was before. But there were, you know, there were people discussing these issues before 9/11, including myself in my last book, The Cash Nexus, at a time when nobody thought it remotely a serious proposition. Clearly, 9/11 created opportunities that weren't there before, mainly because the American electorate was prepared to do much more than it had been prepared to countenance before. But I still think that the objective is not to reconstitute the British Empire, but rather to use America's colossal military power. Remember, the United States has far greater military power today and greater economic power than the British Empire ever had. Its superiority in almost every sphere of warfare is such that it really is in a position to impose its authority pretty much wherever it wishes to. So that's really quite an important point. And the question is how it can use that colossal military power to promote the growth of free institutions, economic, legal, and ultimately political institutions in that very large part of the world where they don't exist.
Well, the minds of those folk have got to be enlisted. When we come back from a break, Arundhati Roy from India. This is The Whole Wide World, coming to you from the studios of WGBH Boston, distributed by PRI Public Radio International.